I'm Shanna Hutchison, dietitian, blogger, and mama, born and raised in the heart of the Midwest. I believe that wellness goes way beyond what we eat and that our body size does not determine our worth. I am passionate about showing other women how to live a life they truly love, one that feels purposeful, that helps them feel their best physically, mentally, and emotionally, and that being a mom can be one of the best things you ever do without it becoming your entire identity. This is a place you can come to hear vulnerable and interesting conversations about health and wellness, motherhood, entrepreneurship, and more. If you want to find freedom with food, learn how to improve your overall well-being, and stop waiting for a number on the scale to start living your best life and go after your goals, then you're in the right place. I'm so excited to learn and grow together. This is the Wellness for the Win podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today is part two of the breastfeeding episode with IBCLC Summer Friedman of Done Naturally. I have so far heard really great feedback from you guys on last week's episode, so I'm really glad it's been helpful so far, and I know you're going to enjoy this continuation of our conversation as well. So here is what you can expect to hear in today's episode. For part two, we are diving into some pumping related things, like what is a normal, quote unquote, normal amount to pump during a session, how many minutes we should be pumping each time. We'll touch on baby sleep. When should babies be sleeping through the night? Should we be pumping if they sleep through the night? Some tips on that. Getting your period back postpartum or while breastfeeding. Clogged milk ducts and how to prevent and treat them. All things mastitis and all the fun stuff that goes along with that. How to manage a super strong letdown, which is really common, especially for second and third babies. And we're also going to touch on some controversial topics in this episode, like tongue ties and lip ties. Not always, I guess, kind of controversial, but also just confusing and sort of misunderstood concepts, I think. So really good to hear from her perspective as far as what the research says and things like that. We also, on that same note, we'll touch on cow's milk protein allergy, how common it truly is, and what the guidelines actually say regarding this. We'll talk about hand expression, which if you've followed me for any length of time, you know that's my favorite topic when it comes to breastfeeding slash pumping. And we will close it out by talking about weaning, because that just made sense to close the conversation that way. I know a lot of you are anticipating that journey in the future, so she has some good tips on what to watch out for when it comes to weaning and how to navigate that process. So let's go ahead and jump right into this episode. Okay, I loved this question. Someone asked about what is considered normal output for pumping, because I think once again, you know, we see on social media people post their pump session and it's like, holy shit, you got so many ounces, and it's, you know, that comparison thing that people drive themselves crazy. So sure. Can you just tell moms what is considered normal for output, you know, how many ounces per session, and I guess maybe like how many minutes of per session that you recommend too for pumping?
Yes, a normal amount to collect while pumping for a missed breastfeed will be anywhere between 2 to 4 ounces total combined between both breasts once mature lactation has been established. So this wouldn't be like in the first 7 to 10 days. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about significantly less milk than that. So she might collect 1.5 ounces per side, or she might collect 1 ounce on the pony and 2.5 on the keg.
yeah.
You know, so when you see the moms that post their bottles, their 8 ounce bottles that they got, you know, one breast got 8 ounces and the other breast got 3. And she's like, this is my pony. And you're like, actually, your pony's your normal one. Mm-hmm. Your keg is like triple duty.
Yeah.
So that's a normal amount. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong if someone collects more than that. Mm-hmm. That's okay, especially if she's not having negative symptoms of oversupply.
And right.
Woohoo for her. Mm-hmm. But you're right. We don't want to compare and then think we're inadequate because, you know, I'm not collecting 5 ounces, or
right.
The assumption that, you know, when you pump, the bottles are 5 ounces each, and that the assumption would be, am I supposed to fill those up with a pump session? Mm-hmm. No, like you're supposed to get 1 or 2 ounces, which is like makes the bottle look so empty, but like that's normal.
Right. So two to four ounces per session total.
Total.
Yep. Okay. Yes. Yep. Okay.
And total collection per day would be close to like 24 ounces, sometimes 28 or 30. Like if someone pumps 8 times a day and collects 4 ounces, that's going to be 32. That's going to be on the high end.
Sure.
If someone pumps 8 times a day and gets 3 ounces, that's right where we would expect 24 ounces.
Okay.
Length of time varies considerably. And again, I keep mentioning flange size. but when you're
it's
in
important.
Little did we know, when you're in a proper sized flange for your nipple diameter, then you can usually use very high suction on your pump and feel nothing and feel comfortable. And you'll see multiple streams of milk, like you remember probably when you were hand expressing, and that increases the collection volume and you can decrease your time. So someone in a good size flange might get all of her pumping volume out in 6 minutes and not have to pump for 15, 20. Some moms tell me they're pumping 30 or 40 minutes. And I'm thinking, oh my God, we have some work to do because that is such a suck of your time.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't take that line. Oh yeah. Total pun. So the better sized you are, then we're going to have more efficient pumping, shorter times, more collection, less pain.
Yeah.
In general, I would say women on average pump like 15 minutes. And when they're using both sides, or if they for some reason only need to pump one. But usually we can bring that down with good flange size. And how awesome for those working moms away from babies, if you can be like, wow, your pump break only has to be 6 minutes.
Like, although most of us are like using that as like a time to like get a snack and relax for a minute. I know I did. I would usually pump for like 15 to 20 minutes or 15 to like 17. But I was also guilty. Again, it's like such a mindset thing because you like you look at the numbers and you like want to see it go up a little bit more. And I'm like, oh, I can get a little bit more if I go a few more minutes. And so I had like a comfortable, I wouldn't say I had an oversupply, but I had more than
you
I
had a lot. I remember. I remember I would see some of your posts and I was like,
I had a lot of milk. I did have a good amount of milk. And it's, again, it's like hard not to like.
It's addictive.
Want to have that excess. It is. It is. It's very satisfying to know that you have enough. And I know, and it's hard because I can't relate to the moms who are so frustrated because they do have that low supply. And so, but I can only imagine like how defeating that would feel because being on the other side where you're like, oh my gosh, I just want to get more and more and more because it's so like satisfying. Yes, exactly. Gratifying for sure. Yeah. It would be tough to be on the other side. So I feel for those moms for sure.
Those moms, I think you mentioned at the very beginning, you said something about low milk supply. And then the next time, like one thing that's awesome that our bodies do is the second time around, we make more milk naturally than the first time around. And then the third time we make more than the second, and the fourth we make more than the third. So our breasts grow more cells that make milk every single time we're pregnant and every lactation experience. So some of those moms who've experienced low milk supply, if there's a next time for them, they will fare better naturally as long as they have good education, good support, you know, good management of milk supply
and baby. Build the house of milk, of course.
And build the house of milk,
Yes. Awesome. Well, that's good to know. And also another random thing I thought of, when we talked about like adding in like that one extra pump session per day, if we want to like build a stash or whatever, would you say, I believe I remember that you kind of recommend doing that after the first feed of the day because we produce more output in the morning. Is that right?
That's right. Usually I have moms do it first thing in the morning just because, yes, your volume of milk is higher between about midnight and 9 a.m. So you can breastfeed the baby whenever morning is for you and then pump immediately after. And just if you put them together, you're just making your day more efficient rather than waiting an hour or an hour and a half. But yeah, in the morning is usually more fruitful use of your time for pumping. And then the other, I neglected to say this, for some women that might not start pumping in the beginning but want to later, if the baby starts sleeping longer at night, that can be an opportunity when you can do a pump session if you've started later. But not all babies will do that. So that's not a guarantee.
Sure. totally. That is a good point. Yeah. And in those early weeks, it's like, what is the time of day anyway? Because we're, you know,
it's baby
pretty
time.
Much up constantly. Yeah. Okay. Another thing. So speaking of which, actually, this brings me to my next question, which is, you know, you always very much normalize babies waking up in the middle of the night. And, you know, as we know on social media, We see a lot of things that make us feel like your baby should be sleeping through the night at X amount of weeks or months or whatever. And so once again, it's the mom's questioning, okay, is something wrong with my baby or the way that I'm parenting because my baby's not sleeping and wanting to nurse all the time. So can you talk a little bit more about, you know, night wakings, how long this can go on, why some babies may wake up more than others, and that this is all normal?
Yes, it is normal. And everybody, you know, maybe the common thread throughout all of this is how different we all are personality-wise. There's sleep personalities, feeding personalities, you know, actual disposition personalities. All of that can come into play with sleep. Sleep is a developmental process. So just like the baby being able to grasp their hands, being able to track with their eyes, being able to roll over, sit up, crawl, sleep is developmental. So when the baby is ready, that the baby will begin to do that. And that time is completely up to them. Sleeping through the night, scientifically speaking, is 5 hours. We all, I think, wish for 8, 10s, and 12s hours of sleep at night. But for technically our babies. Technically speaking, it's 5 hours. I would say by the time babies are, you know, 4 months, 5, 6 months old, usually they're doing on their own, not parent directed or sleep trained, but on their own, they're usually doing 1 4- or 5 hour stretch. I do find that more often than not, it's like 7 to midnight or 1 rather than like midnight to 5. A way to tackle that would be to also go to sleep when the baby goes to sleep early so that you can manage the dark middle of the night hours well. It's totally biologically normal for a baby to wake in the night, just like we do. We don't see it. I mean, if we were to put video cameras on ourselves, we would see how many times a night we get up to go to the bathroom, roll over, fix our pillow, our blankets, make sure our partner's right there, have a drink of water, check the clock, like whatever we're doing, and go back to sleep. And babies, you know, their circadian rhythm is very different than ours. And eventually it moves into more of an adult circadian rhythm, but they need help falling back to sleep. They aren't independent. They are dependent beings. And that usually is suckling to sleep, which is very natural. So whether that's, you know, bottle feeding, breastfeeding, pacifying, whatever that is, they need parents' help guiding them back. And eventually that sleep association can be replaced because, you know, we're not talking about 10-year-olds that are still waking up at night and, you know, parents help them back to sleep. Although they, you know what? Sometimes they do. They have a nightmare and get up and they need some help. So let me put my foot in my mouth there. But yes, it's very normal. The American Academy of Pediatrics does not recommend crying it out at all. Those first 6 months are so heavy in growth. They usually double their birth weight. And so those night feeds become so vital. And that's also when we make the most milk. So, you know, their instinct is strong. They're smart. And they know they're going to get more bang for their buck during those hours. And a mother's milk supply is more at risk if she isn't feeding or stimulating her breasts during those hours. It makes her more likely to lose her supply, to get her period back, to start ovulating, to be at risk for pregnancy, which then pushes her back to colostrum and risks the milk supply. So it's like there's a purpose behind all of it when you look at all of it from the big picture. But it's tiring. I mean, we all know. The one thing I will say is that a lot of breastfeeding moms assume that if the baby is waking a lot at night, that it must mean the baby's not getting enough milk during the day or isn't getting enough at night or her supply is low. And over all these years of working with families who bottle feed breast milk, bottle feed formula, breastfeed, combo feed, mixed feed, whatever, every single one of them have babies who wake in the middle of the night. So for our breastfeeding mothers who don't see the milk coming out of their breasts, we have to remind them that this isn't about enough milk or not. Like babies who have measured milk in their bottles still wake up in the middle of the night. So it's not the solution. It's not about babies are full and so that's why they don't wake up, or they wake up because they're hungry. They're waking up because of their sleep cycle and because it's developmental. They're not starving and they wake up, or they don't fall asleep because they're full. So it's tricky because in the first month, all babies do is sleep and eat. So we're like,
yeah, and poop. Well,
right. So we're like, oh, they must be sleeping because they're full. And then as they get older, they stay awake after they're eating and play, and then they sleep. And then, you know, so sleep is definitely coveted and challenging. And there's many different perspectives and parenting styles per se on sleeping, but night waking is absolutely normal. And there are ways to, if a parent is at their wit's end and needs to, you know, reduce night waking, there's gentle attachment-based ways to do that without risking milk supply and and baby's growth.
I'm proud to be teaming up with Advent Health KC and excited to tell you more about some of the services they offer in the Kansas City area. Did you know they have a brand new hospital located in South Overland Park? It's a state-of-the-art facility that offers a birth center, emergency department, surgical services, heart care, primary care, and more. I had a chance to tour the facility when it first opened, and I can confirm it is absolutely beautiful. But more importantly, they have all the services, providers, and technology you could want to get the right care for your needs. Advent Health is excited to have this hospital at 165th and 69 Highway, which will provide more convenience to those in the area. No matter what healthcare needs you have, they are ready to serve you at Advent Health, South Overland Park. Head to adventhealthkc.com/southop if you want to learn more. I'll leave a link for you in the show notes. Okay, back to the episode. And like you said, you know, it's definitely, of course, it's tiring. You know, we've all been so exhausted and drained in the middle of the night. And I feel like it's more frustrating, like as they get older, when you like know that they're capable of sleeping and they don't necessarily need you as much. And you're used to like 12 hour stretches and they wake up and you're like, what in the world is going on? But in those early months, just remembering like, yes, they are very dependent. They do need our comfort and they just want their mamas, and that's normal and that's okay. You know, so just trust them and be there, and it doesn't last forever. Sadly.
It's hard, especially when you do get the sleep. I remember that where they've like, when they've done the sleep for a predictable amount of time.
Yeah.
And then they wake again and then you're like, oh no. Like,
what's happening?
Like, that's worse.
It is.
Now I've had a taste of the sleep.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. When you're just used to it and you know to expect it, it's so much easier to get up than when you're like, oh shit, I've been sleeping really good lately. And what's happening? So speaking of which, you know, when they do start sleeping better, a lot of people were like, should we continue to pump? Like you mentioned, there's risks
stash.
Of not. Yes. It's right. Like your period could come back. You could start ovulating, et cetera. So, you know, at what point can we possibly stop pumping if they do sleep through the night? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So it depends on mother's circumstances. So for most stay home full time, work from home, and if work from home means breastfeeding while mom's working, so not bottles, then if the baby starts sleeping through the night, mom just gets to kind of like let her body acclimate, doesn't need to wake to pump unless she desires to, just for shiggles. That's fine. But we just kind of let her body figure it out. It's not going to reduce the rest of her supply. She's following the baby's lead. It's totally safe. I'll talk about the other moms too. And then I'll mention the kind of the risks or the thing to take note of. Back to work moms, it's usually a good idea if we're under 6 months to wake up and do one pump in the middle of the night. It's hard for the body to continue making or keep our milk supply high if we are away from our baby during the day and away from our baby at night. Very difficult. So it's an insurance policy, so to speak, but it can really help those moms that are working away from home on a regular basis, or, you know, working from home but pumping and babies elsewhere. So yes, I recommend that if we're under 6 months to do that pump. After 6 months, she's usually okay to do that, to start working on sleeping and missing that pump. And that's usually a nice time to kind of touch base with a lactation consultant to be like, hey, how do I do this? Do I just cut it out? Like, what do I do? The factors that need to be taken into account are, is she using any form of birth control? And that can be, you know, condoms, barrier methods. Has her period started back? If she's not using a form of birth control at all, then that's when you go 5 hours or more. That's the second your hormones can start functioning for ovulation and pregnancy again. So if you don't want another baby, then some moms will pump as a form
of birth control.
Yeah. Yes.
Keep
right.
the period away.
Right. Yeah. So it just depends on the circumstances of the mom and how often she's with baby or away from baby and what she wants out of, you know, does she want a Irish twin or does she want yeah. a little more child spacing?
Right. Totally. Yeah. And a couple of people did ask that. They're like, how, like, I got my period back while I'm nursing. Like, why'd this happen? And I think it just, I mean, I'm sure that that contributes to it, but even for someone who's feeding like super regularly and, you know, mm-hmm. on demand, do some people just get it back earlier than others for no rhyme yep. or reason, really?
Some people do. The form of birth control, like where breastfeeding is used as a form of birth control, is called LAM, L-A-M, the lactational amarenia method. So okay. there's several factors that help that be more protective. And under 6 months postpartum, mm-hmm. if mom has not had a period, is only exclusively breastfeeding, never using a bottle, never using a pacifier, staying in proximity to baby where the hormones are like hyper stimulated, mm-hmm. then the protection is 97 or 98%. So wow. as effective as the birth control pill. Reality is that many people are offering some bottles, doing some pumping, using a pacifier, and there's nothing wrong with any of that.
Right.
But then it becomes less reliable to just be like, breastfeeding keeps the period away. You yeah. know, breastfeeding yeah. will keep other babies away.
Right.
Yeah. So then you'd need a form because, yeah, you can get your period back
yeah.
earlier, even if you have a frequent feeding baby. Mine came back at 7 months postpartum with every single kid. One baby was sleeping through the night by that age, and the other two were up all the time. So, like, mm-hmm. it didn't matter. My body was like, 7 months, go.
Interesting. Huh. That's yeah. funny.
So
I was yeah. lucky. Mine didn't come back till 14 months. So I was like loving it. I was like,
such a dream.
When it came back, I was like, holy shit, I haven't had a period in like years. Literally. You
yeah.
know,
I mean,
between
it's,
yeah, 9 months plus
such
14
a blessing.
Months. It
right.
was. It was. It's like yeah. one less thing to worry about when you have other things.
yeah. That was 2 years. Yeah. That was 2 years without a period for you.
Yeah. It was great. It was glorious.
Awesome.
Yeah. So awesome. Fingers crossed that happens again, but we'll see. Cool. So moving on to clogged milk ducts. So oh. that obviously is a common struggle for mamas. So can yeah. we talk about the best ways to prevent clogs mm-hmm. and how to treat them if and when they do happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, our bodies like predictability. They like milk removal at regular times. So the best way to prevent plugged ducts or even mastitis would be to just keep breastfeeding, try and to avoid skipped feeds, stretching feeds out, missed pump sessions, which sometimes is inevitable.
Right. Life happens.
right. Trying your best to avoid those can help not get milk all bogged down inside of our breasts. There's been some new research that has come out with management of plugged ducts and mastitis that is talking about ice still being more helpful than heat and mm-hmm. working towards the inflammation using ibuprofen, which can help the pain that might be related to the inflammation. In my practice, because this came out like maybe a year and a half ago from a breastfeeding medicine doctor. And so we're all like, you know, chomping at the bit, reading the information. We're like, okay, new stuff. Like, let's see what we've done wrong and how we can fix it.
Yeah.
And so I started telling all my moms, like, okay, now we use ice. We don't use wet heat. You never want to use dry heat, but we don't use wet heat, which is my trick was the hot diaper. So I started talking to them about this. And I would say 90% of them wouldn't respond to the ice and would respond once we started using the hot diaper. But some of them responded to the ice. So what I've been doing now is talking about both and being like, see what works, take some ibuprofen, keep the milk moving. So breastfeeding at your normal frequency. If you're pumping, pumping at your normal frequency. A few things we don't want to do anymore is over pumping. So just because you have a plugged duct, just because you have mastitis, we don't want you then to be like, oh, now just pump after every breastfeed or, you know, add a pump into your nighttime, add a da-da-da. We don't want to do that because that can bring more fluid to the breast, more inflammation to the breast, exacerbate the problem. You know, if your body is regulating and is, you know, trying to figure out if the baby's sleeping through the night and trying to figure that out, we don't want to pump because then your body is not going to figure it out.
Right.
So not doing that. The other thing that we want to avoid is over massage and digging into our breast, which some people will do out of pure.
It's kind of hard not to, because you just
like really want it to get out. And so we're like so committed and we're like, I'm going to get in there. And so what this breastfeeding medicine physician talked about, which I loved hearing, is that the breast is an organ. So it's like a heart. It's like we have to take care for it gently. And if we're digging in, we're going to cause bruising and more swelling and more redness and just, you know, compound the problem.
Yeah.
So we need to treat them very gently. I talk about the hot diaper along with icing to see which she responds to best. Plank feeding, where you're using gravity and possibly rotating around the breast, pull in different directions. And when you do massage, I talk about it like tickling. So it can easily be done with the backs of your fingernails and dragging it along your breast tissue to create like goosebumps. So you're not like creating lines or scratching yourself. It's just a goosebump, and that can help trigger some milk coming down too. So gently handling our breasts, continuing to breastfeed as normal, treating it like inflammation with ibuprofen and ice, seeing how we respond to heat, resting, which is a big one. It's hard for people to do. Like you need to treat yourself like you're sick. You need to like stay in bed, Netflix, Amazon, whatever, and, you know, just hang out, which can be hard if it's just a plugged duct because your boob only feels sick, not the rest of you.
Yeah.
With mastitis, you're bedridden because you have the aches and the chills and the boob hurts too, and you just feel terrible. But plugs can also be treated with just rest and breastfeeding or pumping on a regular pattern, and they should really only last, you know, 2 or 3 days. And if someone's getting them often, or they're not going away, or they're reoccurring, then she needs to talk to a lactation consultant to figure out the root of the problem.
Right.
One mom we just figured out had a bra that was like digging in on a certain section when she wore the bra at night. She was fine during the day, but would have problems at night. So she finally figured that away, and now she's okay. So it can be tricky to figure out the why. Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. We just,
for sure.
But, yeah.
Gosh, I forgot about wearing a bra to bed. That part sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
That part's no fun. Yeah.
So if you're a leaker, it can help. If you're not a leaker, then sometimes you can get away with not wearing a bra, or just wearing like a loose fitting tank or cami or something. But yeah.
It takes time for sure. Yeah.
That does.
That's a good reminder. Taking a quick break to share some items that I personally loved during my breastfeeding / pumping journey and where you can find them. So starting off with the Breast Friend pillow, I used that for pretty much every single feeding that we did at home. I even brought it with me sometimes. I found it to be a lot more supportive and comfortable than other options, such as the Boppy pillow, for example. I sometimes brought that for travel because it was a little less bulky, but I stand by the Breast Friend pillow. It was the best, in my opinion, and in our experience. But I would also roll up a little blanket or towel under the side of the pillow where Rhett's head was to prop him up even more toward me and reduce the need to bend over to meet him. I also highly recommend using a footstool if you're nursing at home on a chair or on a couch or something like that, because it helped so much with posture and reducing bending over as well. I don't know about you, I struggled hardcore with some really bad back pain early postpartum, and I know that nursing was part of that because I was like constantly slouching. So focusing on better posture was really helpful for me. I'm also going to link up some of the best burp cloths for you from Amazon. Rhett was a total spit up king, so we were constantly doing laundry, and it was so nice to have a ton of these on hand because we definitely needed them. They're really affordable, which is the great part, and they're the perfect size, perfect material. You just like every single new mom needs them. I get them for everyone at showers, even if they didn't ask for them. So I've linked all these items and some other postpartum essentials on my Amazon affiliate storefront, and you can also go to my blog, wellnessforthewin.com, to find tons of other motherhood related posts such as baby registry must haves, like things that you actually need and more. So I will leave some links to these things in the show notes for you guys if that's helpful. And let's go ahead and get back to the episode with Summer. And so speaking of, so like with clogged ducts, because yes. clogged ducts technically are what lead to mastitis, right? Like they're a result of an unresolved clogged duct.
So you can have a plugged duct that, or clogged duct, whatever we want to call it, that goes unresolved and then can become like, yes, graduate into mastitis. And then if that's unresolved, that can graduate into a breast abscess. Mm. So yeah, anytime we have a section of the breast that is what I call angry, she needs attention because we want to try to avoid the two other ones that are more of an emergency than a plugged duct. The breastfeeding medicine doctor was chatting about how she doesn't think that people just wake up with mastitis. But I have had, so some of it, as we're all reading, you know, we're like, huh, interesting. Not sure. I'm going to try it in our practice, see what happens. Because we've all had women that have woken up with mastitis and they've woken up with the fever and the aches and the chills and, you know, but it might not be bacterial. Right? Like she might not need antibiotics. It might be just inflammation that needs some settling. So everybody's so different and not one thing works for everybody. And it's painful, but if we just keep the breast moving, we can usually avoid them. And some women never have any. I mean, I had tons with my first and never had any with my second two. So
interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. And then some people respond really well to the sunflower lecithin supplement. It does not increase milk supply. It does not change the fat or the structure of the milk, like some people will say, but it can help supposedly make milk come through the duct walls in a little more slippery of a process. Works for some, doesn't for others. Lots of gray there.
Well, and I know I have heard people talk about, you know, some people take it all the time preventatively.
Right.
I just saw another lactation consultant post this the other day, and I was curious your thoughts on, you know, using it as like
prophylactic.
Yes. Like not using it all the time to prevent it from happening, but more so, okay, now I have a plugged duct. I'm going to take it now to kind of like loosen things up if that's what it does. And or like, for example, the one time that I got very close to having mastitis, it was like during a feed, I had a plugged duct and I could feel that I was getting a fever and I took my temperature and it was a little bit high and I was able to avoid antibiotics and getting full blown mastitis because I think I took ibuprofen. I can't even remember all the things that I did, but what are some things that we can like do proactively if we feel like, okay, a fever's coming on? Like, how can I, can you, is avoid. There a way to always avoid mastitis or?
Yeah.
You kind of catch it.
If you can pay attention to the plugged duct with some actions sooner than later, the better. Like a lot of people will try be in denial where they're like, oh, this is probably isn't one. Yeah. And the day goes on, they're like, oh no. Yes, it is. So the sooner attention you can pay to it, the better. Most people can avoid antibiotics if the fever goes down within 24 hours or so.
Okay.
And they see an improvement in their symptoms. Then there's other people that need courses of antibiotics and some of them don't respond to the course of antibiotics and then they need a different course of antibiotics. So yes, you can totally avoid mastitis if you pay attention. And some of it, you know, the sleep through the nights might just be a plug, but maybe you do wake up with a fever. A fever doesn't always mean bacteria. It can mean virus. It can mean inflammation too. So that's what this new research was showing, was like, doesn't mean it's bacteria. Like the woman isn't going to breastfeed and suddenly have a bacterial infection that needs antibiotics.
Right.
And also, can we reduce the amount of antibiotics we're dosing out to women that could very well be unnecessary because antibiotic resistance is a real thing.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know? So I think we overuse them for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. Okay. So what about, I know you mentioned like with each baby, we produce more milk than the previous one. So does that also mean typically do people experience a stronger letdown with subsequent pregnancies as well? And like, what are some tips, or even for first-time moms who are having a super strong letdown, like what are some tips for how to manage that? Because it can be really hard, especially for tiny little babies that are like, whoa, that's a lot. You know, how can we kind of like make it calm down so that they're feeding well and not feeling like they're drowning in your mouth.
Drowning, right. Yeah. So babies are really good at protecting their airway and they have a really strong, healthy gag reflex. Mm-hmm. So when you hear the baby making noise, it's a good sign. So it's a sign that they're making effort to protect themselves. So mm-hmm. the choking, the gagging, the sputtering, the pushing away where they take their hands and press the breast and move away. Mm-hmm. You want to allow them to do that. So they might come off the breast and need a minute before they mm-hmm. come back on. Meanwhile, you might be streaming all over the place.
Yeah. Have something close
you
by.
Know, so. Yeah. Like there's a towel or, you know, some container you can spray into. And then when the baby's ready to come back, they can come back. Mm-hmm. Some of that will adjust with time. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the first 6 to 12 weeks is when our supply kind of regulates and the baby continues as they age to get more efficient, to be able to take in more volume as opposed to, you know, being overwhelmed by the volume. So a lot of times it will settle itself out without any like intervention, so to speak. We don't want to like pump off milk and then attach the baby. Like that is just cumbersome and in the end doesn't help anything. Like we want our body to adjust and acclimate. We don't want to keep making the extra milk. Mm-hmm. Reclining, using a very reclined position for breastfeeding, also called laid back breastfeeding, sidelying breastfeeding so that the excess milk just goes on to the bed and doesn't overwhelm the baby. That can help quite a bit. Yes, second, third, fourth, subsequent babies and lactation experiences, your milk comes in faster, it comes in more plentifully, and usually we see more a stronger letdown.
Okay.
But it adjusts. Sometimes that first morning pump that a mom would do, like you might be doing with going back to work, mm-hmm. can help you get through several feedings after that where the baby's not struggling as much. Mm-hmm. And then the other ones as the day kind of goes on, you know, might coincide with, you know, your supply taking a little bit of a decrease that the baby's like, oh, thank God, mom's not waterboarding me anymore. Yeah. But that's where you don't want to get into the, I'm going to haka off before I attach the baby. Like that's just going to make it worse.
Sure.
So more often than not, we don't really actively intervene for the first 6 weeks because there's so much adjusting going on. And between 6 and 12, there's a hormone drop that usually tapers our milk down a little bit that will settle it. Mm-hmm. Women that have a real hard time, like if they've had just, you know, massive oversupply and hyperactive letdown, there's ways we can manage that that can help it adjust sooner and give her more comfort. Because sometimes it's about discomfort and sometimes it can lead to breastfeeding aversion for the baby. Mm-hmm. And so when we get into that category, then we're going to intervene. But if the baby is somewhat handling it okay and not showing aversive signs, then usually the reclining, sidelying, you know, one a day pump, if she is in that category where she would do that, usually do just fine. And letting the baby come off if they need to come off. Like,
yeah,
it's okay. Like,
yeah,
wait, dude, like, hold on. Or you might see milk coming out of the corners of their mouth because they have to.
Yeah.
They don't have that much space for the milk that's coming out. You might hear a lot of noisy nursing, you know, clicks and sounds, and, you know, it doesn't mean anything bad. It's just because there's so much volume coming out for their normal amount of effort. Like your next baby is going to have a newborn suckle with a certain amount of newborn strength. And Rhett had that too. But this new baby is going to do a newborn suck and elicit more milk than Rhett had to deal with because it's your second, you know?
Yeah.
So he's going to be like, oh, mom, that was more than I bargained for. Like, hold on.
Yeah.
And they might spit up more. And that's their way of, you know, compensating for what they don't need. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Usually those babies gain really quickly. And they might need like suckle that isn't at the breast. Some of these moms, pacifiers become so important because the baby can't pacify on her without getting tons of milk.
Yeah.
Those babies, pacifying and non-nutritive sucking is so, and comfort nursing is so important for babies. Bottle fed, breastfed.
Yeah.
And so if a baby goes to a mother and she has a boatload of milk and a hyperactive letdown and a little bit of oversupply, When the baby's full, they don't want milk anymore. They can't comfort nurse because she's going to respond well with milk. So then the baby has to have some pacifier time because they can't. Mother's always going to respond with milk in that case, in her circumstance. So Passy can be helpful in that case too.
Yes. Yeah. We've always been big fans of the pacifiers over here. Rhett loves his Binkies. So we'll see. I'm curious to see if this next baby is a Binky baby as well. We will see. One brand that we have used and loved throughout Rhett's whole life is Tubby Todd. You may have heard of them, but if not, you're welcome. They have a wide variety of products that are pediatrician and dermatologist tested, and they have gentle body care basics for the whole family, including you, mama. They're actually famous for their all-over ointment, which you may have heard of. We used this a ton when Rhett was just a little baby, and it helped a lot with his cradle cap and other dry patches of skin, and we continue to use their bath soaps and shampoos to this day. They have tons of yummy scents, all with great ingredients. Another item of theirs that we love is their Sweet Cheeks diaper paste. It helps so much with diaper rash and makes it go away super quickly, which always makes me really happy because to me, there's like nothing sadder than a baby's red, irritated booty. So we love that product. The last Tubby Todd product I want to mention right now is their mineral sunscreen. We especially love the face stick for Rhett because it's really easy to apply on a busy toddler who will only sit still for a few seconds. You can check out all of these products and more by visiting my affiliate link in the show notes, which also gets you 10% off your purchase at Tubby Todd. Happy shopping. Okay, so a couple of controversial topics that we have to touch on because there's a lot of talk about them these days. And I know you have, I think you have feelings on them as well.
So I have feelings on so many things.
I know, me too. I think we have a lot in common personality wise. But I'd love to hear your thoughts as well as the research on things like tongue ties and lip ties.
Sure.
Or that's what they are, right?
Yes.
Lip ties. Okay.
Yep.
So we hear a lot about those these days. So, you know, can you talk about what they are, how common they truly are, and how often do they actually require intervention for feeding and speech and things like that?
Yeah. So there are ankyloglossia is the technical term for what people call tongue tie.
Okay.
But it's called a sublingual, so under the tongue frenulum. We all have a sublingual frenulum. We have to. It's the piece of tissue that attaches the tongue to our base of our mouth. Everyone has to have one.
Right.
And ankyloglossia is where that piece of tissue has restricted the tongue's mobility. So tongue mobility is incredibly important in being able to manipulate milk out of the breast. We like to see extension of the tongue, elevation of the tongue, lateralization of the tongue, and we like to see happy nipples. and we like to see a thriving baby who's gaining weight well, and the mother and baby are happy. So when you have a tongue that is restricted and unable to extract milk or breaks the mother's nipples all up, then that's when we need intervention and you need an assessment. Someone to watch the feeding, someone to do an oral assessment and see, is that what is doing it? Sometimes it might not be. It could be simple as positioning and latch optimization that corrects the problem. The instance of tongue tie or ankyloglossia is less than 5% of all babies. 3 to 5% of babies are born with a frenulum under their tongue that would need some intervention. Mm. To me, that makes perfect sense because I'm a big common sense girl. It would be really weird if there was most babies that are born needing a surgical procedure or intervention in order to feed normally.
Right.
Our species wouldn't work.
Right.
So it makes sense that it's more of an anomaly. Mm-hmm. Now online, you will read all sorts of things where people are having revisions, incising, you know, these frenulums all over the place, lasering, scissors, you know, just everything. So the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine is an organization of physicians that specialize in lactation. And they are a group of them all across the world. So it's a huge organization and they're responsible for writing all the protocols for supplementation, for recommendations on breastfeeding, for mastitis protocol, for ankyloglossia protocol, like just everything. Like, what do we do when a baby's blood sugar is low? Like, just they have all of that. It's who writes breast milk storage that then who pulls from and AAP pulls from. So they're kind of like, they're the source, I guess, like the top source. So they have a position statement that came out in 2021 on ankyloglossia. And if anybody wants this, of course, I'm happy to send it to you so you can send that out.
Sure.
But what you read in that, number one, you'll see that buccal ties, people call buccal ties, should not be revised. This is when people are being told that the cheek tissue is too tight. And so a laser at a pediatric dentist will, you know, laser all that skin and muscle and everything, that it's not recommended to revise a lip tie. And a lip tie is what's called an upper labial frenulum that would be restricted. And that's super unusual too, because everyone has an upper labial frenulum. It connects our lip to our gums.
Right.
And you can feel it up there. And so you'll see people will lift baby's lips and be like, my baby has one. You're like, well, of course they have one. They have to.
Yeah, we have one too.
Yeah. But what you want is the baby to, like, can you run your finger across there? Can the baby roll their tongue? Severe ones are going to be, I forget, we're not on video and I keep touching my face to show everybody. severe ones would have that frenula attached at the very tip of the lip to where the baby's lip is literally rolled under. And those babies would have a really hard time sealing to the breast. So the lips function is for seal, so the baby can stay on the breast, and the tongue function is manipulating the milk out of the breast. So they recommend against revising lip tie. They recommend only using scissors. And this is long history. Like, the sublingual frenulum has a long history of when it is in fact there and impeding growth, nipple, milk transfer, that using scissors to revise is extremely low interventive and does improve breastfeeding outcomes, milk transfer, mother's pain, all of that. So that's the one, that's the 3 to 5% of all babies that when revised with scissors improves outcomes. Anterior ties are the ones that are, that we see with the scissors. Posterior is farther back, and it is not recommended to revise those either. It's not recommended to use lasers. So the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, called ABM, was like, it was eye-opening, like, for many. There's still some resistance among even colleagues of mine. Again, I'm a common sense girl. You know, babies are born to do this. And then I'm also a research girl. So, like, if the people that are studying this, that are kind of my governing body, I feel like I got to listen to them, you know, and what they're doing. Lactation consultants, our skills are, we have high skills in attachment to the breast and observing feedings and milk transfer and position and all of that stuff. And so some people, I think, will underutilize their skills and instead rely on revisions. And many people, when interviewed, say they saw no difference. Things still stayed bad. Baby wasn't feeding well. They didn't address the actual issue, which is very frustrating. And I also get frustrated because families are vulnerable. They want to fix things. And when it's going hard, they want to do whatever they can naturally. You know, it's a natural feeling to want to solve the problem and make things better. And I think some families are getting taken advantage of, where they're being told there's ties that aren't lined up with the research. And then these families are getting sent to other practitioners to take their baby to several times a week for 6 weeks, and then go and get the laser procedure done, which is out of pocket and not covered by insurance. And it can be upwards of $800. The scissor revision can be done in the hospital. The scissor revision can be done in an office. It's 2 seconds long. It's covered by insurance. And then you have these families that are in this constant struggle and want things better, but are just bouncing around to all these appointments. And it's stressful and super expensive.
Yeah.
And so then my common self person in me thinks, this is interesting. So what other parts of the world, you know, there's many other parts of the world that don't have access to all these specialized practitioners that we do in, in the part of the world that we are in. What do they do? Like they're not bouncing around to all these specialized practitioners and they don't have higher incidences of tongue tie. So what's going on here? And I have families who've done them and I have every respect for them. And I'm not going to be like, you did something I don't agree with.
Yeah,
like,
right.
No, I'm here to support you. Like you do what you feel is best. I will give you information and I will continue to support you through your journey. I'm not here to make decisions for you at all. So, but I like people to be well-informed. So
for sure.
I think it's going to change in the next 10 years. People are going to start seeing that it's being over-diagnosed and over-corrected
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Just putting the baby through unnecessary pain. The laser revisions are really intense. There is a lot of, you know, like pain afterwards. There can be breast refusal afterwards, bottle refusal afterwards. And a lot of times it doesn't correct the issue. You know,
yeah.
So I think things are going to change. I was glad the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine came out with a statement in 2021. I think that was incredibly helpful. And we need to listen to the science. Like that's, you know, what we're supposed to do.
Right. Yeah. If they're looking at, you know, all these people who have gone through it and they're saying, oh, yeah, actually, it didn't help. You know,
right.
I think that's important for moms to know. Because
right.
I think it's so normal, especially early postpartum, to be desperate for things to be better if you're struggling with something. So I think it's very, very valid to think, oh, that's the problem, especially if, you know, practitioners are telling you that.
Yeah.
You know, you're obviously going to believe them and say, okay, this is the answer. But
if you want to trust them.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's hard. It's hard to navigate it. And it's really hard when there are conflicting opinions within one industry and you have built trust with someone. I mean, I have friends in my field that we don't agree on this part and we just have to agree to disagree, you know,
right.
Like I'm not going to, you know, die on that one. Die,
right.
You know, like,
yeah.
I still have much respect for that person.
For sure.
But we just don't agree on that. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, like,
absolutely.
We still just want to help moms.
Yeah.
And babies.
Exactly. You have that in common and that's what, that's what matters. So another highly controversial one is cow's milk protein intolerance. I think that is equally very
Those
much
are two hot
about.
Buttons.
Yes. Yes. Very sensitive topics. And I just know, you know, so many moms end up cutting out dairy while they're breastfeeding because they're told that they need to. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think in some cases, yes, people do see an improvement. But, you know, can you tell us what the research says again on maybe like the incidence of like how often this is actually truly allergy or intolerance or whatever, you know, how common is that? How often should moms actually be cutting out dairy? And what are some other factors that could possibly be leading to similar symptoms that make people think that that's what the problem is?
Yeah.
A loaded
so many.
Question.
Yeah, that's okay. it's a loaded topic. When you come down to it, it's similar to what we were talking about with ankyloglossia, which is when we have a baby who is struggling, whatever that might be that the parents are describing. They're in search of a solution and they will do anything to feel like they're doing all they can to make the baby better.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
And nobody likes a fussy baby. It's hard when a baby is crying and you can't figure it out or acting unwell. So there was a recent study research that came out May 26th of 2022. Detection and management of milk allergy. So this was a big deal when this came out because this has been a hot topic for a long time and a hot topic that I've been hot on for years. So for me, it was validating to read this, but I just want to make sure everybody understands that like I will support anybody through whatever journey they go through, even if it's not what I might be saying here and not in line with what, you know, I believe or what I see in the science. I'm always there to support my families. And like you said, if someone sees a difference, no matter what it might be, if they see it, then they should keep doing what's working.
Right. Right.
Like I'm not going to be the one to be like, don't do it. And like, you know, like if it's working, keep going. Right.
Yeah.
So cow's milk, and this is coming from, I'm making some quotes from the study, which I can also send to you so you can send out.
Yep.
Cow's milk allergy affects up to 1% of European children in their first 2 years. So this very small.
Yeah, 1%.
And again, common sense me, entire world thinker when I'm thinking about breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. People eat so differently all around the world. And we have this idea in America, or, you know, like Northern America, Southern America, Europe, parts of English speaking parts of Europe, Australia, where like we shouldn't eat certain foods. Mm-hmm. But then other parts of the world eat those foods. And like it doesn't make any sense. Like worldwide, all breastfed babies are all over the world, born to mothers who eat all sorts of foods. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it's supposed to be, right? What this came out with saying is that maternal dietary restriction is not usually necessary for a breastfed infant with suspected or even proven milk allergy. Reading through all my highlighted points, consensus was reached that milk allergy does not need to be considered for changes of color, frequency, or consistency of stool. That's a big one. That's a one huge reason why people will eliminate dairy from their diet.
Right.
So that they do not need to do restriction for those reasons. They don't need to do dietary restriction for aversive feeding. They do not need to for occasional spots of blood in the stool, nasal or respiratory symptoms. So a lot of those things are the reason people will eliminate. Mm-hmm. And elimination it's a lot.
Yeah. Like,
for some people, dairy is a staple in their diet. For other mm-hmm. people, it's consumption of butter and creamer in their coffee or yogurt, or, you know, like they might not be just doing cow, like literally drinking cow milk. It might just be right. in products that they eat.
Right.
But it can be a heavy burden mm-hmm. for these moms, and they're for willing sure. to do it again because, like, all due respect, they want to make life easier for their baby. Right. And right. we will do anything for that, but it can be incredibly burdensome. So this study was talking about consensus was reached that breastfeeding should be supported in line with the WHO, the World Health Organization, and reassuring families that breast milk is the most appropriate for children with or without milk allergy. The only absolute medical contraindication to breastfeeding is galactosemia. That's it. That's the only, and that's rare. Again, we're talking like less than 1%, which makes sense for our species. Mm-hmm. So they talk about how milk elimination diets can be burdensome, and dietary exclusion advice may cause maternal anxiety, may cause maternal depression, weight mm-hmm. loss, and reduced breastfeeding confidence and early weaning or breastfeeding cessation. So what's happening is we're telling these moms to restrict their diet. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Most of the time they don't see a difference. And then they're afraid to start it again. Just even mm-hmm. if they don't see a difference, they're afraid to start it. And again, we could have anxiety or depression, which we're all vulnerable for in postpartum period.
Right.
And it can lead to, this sucks so bad, I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
And yeah. what we really want to do is increase breastfeeding longevity and exposure to breast milk. They also list that unnecessary exposure to specialized formula could have negative effects for young children, that long-term outcomes have not yet been fully characterized to this specialized formula. And these products can affect taste perception and impact growth trajectory and have been associated with micronutrient deficiencies. Hmm. So these other formulas, if you look at the ingredients, it's, as a dietitian, I'm sure you're like, oh no, that's mm-hmm. what's in there. You know, when they're not whey-based or cow milk-based formulas. Hmm. The other thing that's interesting for me is we have all of these mothers who formula feed, and that is 100% their choice. I am never here to judge people. It's you do you, right? So there's so many babies that are formula fed, either exclusively or partially, and they're drinking, most of them, basic cow milk formula, right? Mm-hmm. So that baby is being exposed directly into their digestive tract, cow milk, right? And I would say, I'm huge guess here. If we have, like, let's say it's 200 families we're looking at that their babies are exclusively formula fed or mixed fed, 90% of those families are not going to tell you that their babies are having a hard time with that formula. They're all right. doing fine, right? Right? Then we have these 200, let's say, breastfeeding families. 90% of those people are being told they can't have any dairy. How does that make any sense when you have babies who are living on cow milk formula directly, but these breastfeeding moms are being told they can't have dairy because it's going to affect the baby through their milk? Like, talk about so far removed.
Right.
That part doesn't make sense. Not to mention, this article talks about how we have formula companies and their education and wanting to push people to certain formulas impacting the decisions that physicians are making or providing information. So it's conflicting, right? It's bias. So we want babies to be happy and healthy and thriving. Babies can have bloody stools for many different reasons. And they're even saying in this study that that's not a reason to do dietary restrictions for mom. Mucousy stools, not a reason. Frequency of stools, not a reason. Fussiness in baby, not a reason. So we want babies on this breast milk. We want mothers to succeed. We want them to live their normal life. And babies, it mentions as well, there's normal baby infant behaviors that just are part of babyhood that has been for a long time associated with it must be CMPA, cow's milk protein allergy, or, you know, and it's like, but wait, these are normal things babies do. Like, should we be impacting breastfeeding outcomes by telling these mothers to do this?
Right.
And there's babies of mothers who don't have dairy at all. I've worked with some of those mothers who are like, oh no, my husband can't do dairy himself, so we are a dairy-free household always. And she still experiences some of the same things that people eliminate dairy for. So moms out there, I hear you. I know how frustrating it is when you're worried about your baby and your baby is giving you undesirable behavior. You know, that it's not just a peaceful child laying in your arms or seems in pain. I get it. And, you know, just do your research, do what you need to do. You'll, of course, make your own decision. But in the end, we need to protect our breast milk for those babies and protect our mothers from anxiety and depression and not give them undue
stress,
life restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, dairy is a huge staple in our household. So it would be, I mean, it wouldn't be impossible, but it would be really hard and really burdensome, especially too, because dairy is an incredible source of easy nutrition.
Easy protein, calcium.
Postpartum, you can just pop some, you know, a cheese stick or cheese slices or
yogurt.
Greek yogurt. You know, there's so many wonderful, nutritious options when it comes to dairy that are easy. And we need easy when we're postpartum.
So we do.
And so protein. Dairy is a staple for you, you know. Just do some research as far as, like, you know, other possibilities and, you know, check in with a lactation consultant to see, okay, what else could be possibly going on? And what else could we do to maybe resolve these issues?
And as you know, in postpartum, easy is good. And protein is metabolized slower than anything else. So when you're stuck, you know, what do people call it? Nap trapped or, you know, like if you have some high protein things right there, that's a good choice. And you're right. Yogurt and string cheeses and protein shakes that might be whey based, like super helpful. So, but yes, get in contact with someone, make sure this person is not operating black and white and that will hear you for you and support you no matter what.
Absolutely.
So,
amen to that. Okay, we have just a few more questions. Oh my gosh, go for it. We could probably go for 4 hours.
Shannon and I are gonna just talk all the whole week.
Okay, we have like just a couple more. But one thing that I wanted to touch on was hand expression. I know we kind of touched on it a little bit before, but I say it all the time, but I will shout it from the rooftops because it's so life-changing as a breastfeeding mom and or pumping mom to have this tool in your toolbox because you have your hands with you 24/7. And, you know, if you're stuck in a place.
And your breasts.
Your hands and your boobs are always there. And this actually, like, it saved me one time because we went to a wedding and I forgot one of my pump parts and wouldn't have been able to pump. And I thank God, was very, very good at hand expressing. And I had a very efficient, you know, session of hand expressing out in the car, and I could go back in and go about my evening. And, you know, if I didn't know I had a hand express and effectively remove milk, I would have been like, shit, I have to leave because my boobs are going to explode, you know? So can you talk
or
about-
Or have gotten a plug duct or mastitis.
Right, right. Exactly. And right. So yeah, can you talk about hand expression, some tips and how and why it can be so amazing?
Yeah, it's so amazing. It helps women feel more proficient with themselves. Mm-hmm. It increases your confidence because like, being able to use your hands and get milk out and see it spray across the room, there is some serious like superwoman power feeling when you do that. And for women who've never been taught, it can be reassuring that milk comes out. Mm-hmm. Like if they're worried that, oh my gosh, I think my baby is fussy because there's no milk left. And then, you know, she'll hand express and be like, there's milk. So it can help that if the baby is bobbing around the breast and not quite getting there, you can hand express onto their lips or their, you know, their tongue, and then they can be oriented to go and latch on. You mentioned your, that's a perfect example, you know, being stuck somewhere, you left one little piece and your pump won't work, or you forgot your pump, or you thought you'd be home in time, or you're stuck in traffic.
Right.
And you can hand express into anything, any collection container, even if it ended up being
in the sink.
Right.
Like, if you have to.
Yeah. You're at some game and you didn't bring anything and you need to hand express down a sink. You're saving yourself from plugs and mastitis. You're saving your milk supply. So Stanford has a great a video on doing it. I have a video on how to hand express as well. I'm sure many other LCs do. And there is magic spots. And I'm sure you found yours where like certain areas where you press that just like explode milk out and other ones that are like, that's not the ticket. And practice is key. So that's one of the things every mom, I work with in the home on Tella, she learns how to hand express. And I can teach it in like 3 seconds, but her practice of it and finding her little spot is the part that really helps her have access to be able to get milk out without any tools. And in emergencies is so helpful.
Yeah.
I had an experience like yours. Like I went to, we were at a lake vacation with my children. And my youngest at the time was maybe 20 months or so. He was still breastfeeding. And I didn't bring a pump because I was going to be with my baby, you know. Yeah, so why would I bring a pump? Well, we had driven however far to get to the lake. And then he wasn't interested in feeding. You know, he was this busy little toddler. And my breasts were like not happy about it. And so I sat down with a pint glass and hand expressed like 1.5 ounces or something in an extremely short amount of time and was like, whew, thank God. Okay, let's move on with my day. I'm not uncomfortable now. Like, here we go.
Yeah.
So, so many instances where it can be helpful just as a backup to know how to do.
Yeah.
And learn more about your body. It's so cool when we women, I mean, we do have wondrous bodies that are spectacular. So when we can like manipulate them ourselves, like that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's very empowering, you know? For sure.
And it's a total fun hat trick to like hand express and like shoot your partner in the stomach or the eye or whatever.
it's a superpower, that's for sure. Okay, and then it feels appropriate to end on weaning because you know, kind of the end of the journey.
Yeah,
a lot of people did have questions on and you know, there's hormonal shifts that we experience. There's obviously, you know, again, wanting to avoid clogs and plugs and all the things while we're weaning. So what are some of your best tips on weaning? You know, how fast or slow we should do it? You know, what does that process typically look like or any like of your best tips for those moms?
Yeah, I think you and I spoke to this, or I can't remember. I feel like we did when you were around this time with Rhett. The first thing to know is that it's extremely normal to have simultaneous conflicting feelings about it.
Yes.
And that can be shocking because you can feel ready and then you start doing it and you're like, I'm not ready. Mm-hmm. Yes, I am. I'm not ready. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, I'm touched out. No, I'm not. Come back. You know, like.
Yeah, totally.
So that's normal. And it's normal for it to take time to get used to the idea of not breastfeeding, to miss it, to be happy you're done. and have those feelings in the same day, in the same 1 hour period.
Mm-hmm.
It is best done, as Lalecha League would say, gradually with love. So slowly is better physically for mother.
Yeah.
Emotionally too, hormone wise as well. It's going to be easier on baby as well to slowly transition into something, a new place. And if someone needs to do it in a more fast time frame, for there could be a medical reason, there could, you know, who knows, multitude of reasons that that could happen. There's ways to do it where she's still safe. And I think a lot of people hesitate to reach out to a lactation consultant at this point because they feel like, wait, lactation consultants don't help with weaning, but we do, like, or embarrassed or thinking the LC will judge or the LC will try to talk them into not weaning.
Right.
And maybe there's LCs out there that are like that, but that's 100% not me. And, you know, helping guide her feelings, because it's definitely, there's an acceptance to all of it. I do find that when women, when they've really digested it and thought about, am I ready? And kind of come to that conclusion, I feel like they move through it easier.
Yeah.
I feel like they have less what's called weaning depression because it's been slower and they allow for the, you know, constant changing feelings of them, of baby, of all of it. I feel like that's easier for mom. If someone's still making a considerable amount of milk and she's weaning more in a more kind of haste, like really
like aggressively.
Needing to, like really needs to be done, that hormone shift is going to be much more significant to her and she's going to be at more risk for weaning depression. And weaning depression doesn't mean you need medication. It doesn't mean you're going to have depression for the rest of your life. It's just interesting feelings that maybe you haven't had before, where you're feeling a little more down and you might not know. And so if someone puts a name on it, well, you've just had a big hormone shift. It's like the baby blues after delivery, right? So after weaning, done the same thing, and you can have hormonal reasons for feeling that way. And then you can have emotional and mental reasons for feeling that way. I like to talk to moms about how, you know, when they've breastfed, when they've bottle fed, the relationship that they've built with that baby, you will still always nurture that child. Even after weaning, it's just not going to be with your breast, with feeding, with your milk. It's going to transition to something different.
Yeah.
But it is better to do it slower. I'm working with several moms right now on their weaning plans and checking in with them to make sure they feel okay and adjusting things as we need, as we see, as everybody's body responds differently. Some people can wean rather quickly without pain. Some people need to move slower because their body takes a little longer to adapt. And then you have to account for feelings and welcome all of them because they're there. Yeah. But weaning is a part of breastfeeding. And lactation consultants are here to support you through that process and make sure that we do it safely for mom. So we don't get those scary things like plug ducts, mastitis, and breast abscesses, because those things or for the birds.
That is the truth. Yeah, that's those are all really good tips. And yes, definitely give yourself so much grace and also prepare the people in your life for that transition as well, like your partner especially. Say, hey, you know, my emotions might be a little wild during this time. So have patience with me and I may need extra support or help or whatever. I think that can be helpful to just kind of watch out for.
Yeah, it is. They often can see the effects before you notice you're feeling them. So they can be your eyes better than you can.
Yeah.
You know, they might notice it first. What's wrong with you? You know? I don't know.
I don't know. Why am I crying? Like you said, like the baby blues all over again. That's a very accurate description, I would say.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, this was amazing. So many good things that we touched on. Like I said, we could probably talk for another hour because
I know.
I even had more questions that people asked. And I'm like, I think we touched on majority of them. A lot of them did kind of overlap, but I just so appreciate your time and your expertise and your compassion for moms. And like you said, you know, not judging or telling people what they should do or how they should do it, but really meeting them where they are and knowing that it's such a vulnerable time in our lives. And we just want the best for our babies, and we want to feel good about ourselves along the way as well. And
yes,
you know, that could be a challenge at times. So I just appreciate all that you do. And I would love for you to tell people where they can find you, either online or in person, for people who are local to Kansas City.
Absolutely. Well, yes. So you can find me online. I'm known as Done Naturally. You can find me on Instagram, YouTube, my website, LinkedIn, all Done Naturally. Yeah, I'm here in Leawood. I host a monthly support group in person at my house. That's anybody is welcome. You don't have to be a client to come. You can just come. And of course, if you want to contact me to, you know, talk to me, set something up, schedule something, you can contact me via any social media platform that you've happened to find. That's perfectly okay. So yeah, I thank you for having me here. It's always so fun to chat with you.
Yes. And that's good to know for the support group, for, again, for the local peeps.
Yeah.
And like you said, you serve people all over the world, all over the country, virtually, if they want to chat with you for support too.
Yep. And if anybody has any questions or wants some stuff that I chatted about, they can feel free to DM me, message me, email me, whatever. And I will certainly send you anything you need.
Beautiful.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Of course. See you. Bye-bye.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed this episode and took away some tips or wisdom that you can apply to boost your health and happiness starting today. If you did, I would love it if you would subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and review to help other women like you find my show and get inspired to start living a life they love. Also, take a quick screenshot and share it to your Instagram stories. Be sure to tag me at Wellness for the Win so I can see why you love today's show. Thank you so much for listening, and talk to you next time.